Hey, everybody. Good to see folks again. I see some people have found their way to the cafeteria downstairs, so I'm just only jealous. I would love to be down there myself. So we're going to get started. I know we got a couple people that are coming through the gates still, and Dean's down there in the cold making sure that we get them in. But let's go ahead and get ourselves going. Lots of friendly faces here. It's good to see you all. I'm Greg Nelson, the Deputy Director of the Office of Public Engagement, and I'll let my colleagues here introduce themselves in a moment. I'm also now dual-hatted and working directly with the President's Council on Jobs and Competitiveness, which many of your bosses have been involved in, either directly in the council or in helping us think about how to make sure to shape that work and how it can be an effective body for helping create jobs and build the competitive climate here in this country. I wanted to do just a couple things off the top to get us started, but I don't want to take away much time from our content. We've got a good lineup today. We're going to talk about patents. We're going to be talking about innovation and the innovation agenda and how we can make sure that we, as I mentioned before, build a competitive climate here and continue to make the U.S. the best place both to start a business and to do business in the world. And we're going to talk a bit about entrepreneurship, and then we're going to talk about the economy broadly and may delve into some of the corporate tax issues. We would want this to be an opportunity for feedback. I know you're at the end of your board of directors time here, and you, although you look pretty bright-eyed, I imagine you've had a series of other meetings in dark conference rooms, so we want to make sure to get a chance to chat a bit. And then I also want to welcome, I know that some of your colleagues are watching online and participating, so I wanted to welcome them and say thanks for letting us try to pilot out some new ideas for how to do this. With that, I want to turn it over to my boss, Mike Stratmanis, who many of you have all known for 4 years. Mike's one of the key strategists on our business team, working directly with the Jobs Council and also with Valerie Jarrett and the President in driving our work on jobs, on competitiveness, on innovation, on a whole range of economic and constituency issues. So I'm going to turn over to Mike to say a couple things, and then we're going to come back over to this side to Terry, who's going to share with us what's going on the patent side.
Thank you, and I'll echo Greg's welcome. I've been asked to be brief, and so I will be. I thought I'd spend my time. I think everyone around the room are people. You pay a lot of attention to what's going on around here in this town, and in the different policy meetings on the policy issues. And I have people who are we have people who are going to be joining us who are experts, and so I'm not going to spend a lot of time walking through a lot of policy. I thought what I'd do is first offer some comments about tone and about where we are here at the White House and where the President is. Obviously, we are in a time in which every time you turn on the television screen, we're looking at turmoil. We're looking at challenges around the world, and I know that you all, and I know your businesses, are seeing the same things and are facing a set of headwinds that are daunting and that in many ways are unprecedented. And obviously, when we are at the White House here and the President sees those same things, and we have to deal with them, and I wanted to talk to you about our approach. The President remains bullish about our economic recovery, our continuing economic recovery, and about America being the best place to start and grow a business. He sees, we just saw that the Business Roundtable released their survey. They see job creation. That makes us feel great. And I think as he talks to and goes around the country and talks to business leaders. He was out at Intel. As he talks to citizens across the country, he was just at a science fair yesterday in New York City. He sees confidence. He sees people who are building things. He sees people who are innovating. And I think that if we continue to push forward, if we continue to try to find common ground here in this town, and we continue to give people outside of this town and here the tools so they can continue to innovate, they continue to grow, they continue to build. You know, this theme about winning the future is one that the president is going to stay on, and one that I think matches not only the spirit of the American people, but the focus of this industry, and the focus of all of you, the focus of your business leaders, and the focus on your of your employees. And so we're going to stay at it. I'm spending a lot of my time talking to business leaders, working with Valerie Jarrett, who is obviously talking to CEOs all the time, small and large. We just had a session at Treasury just a few weeks ago on access to capital and way to help entrepreneurs grow their business and continue to propel forward. We think that is going to be a source of tremendous job creation, which is why we have our Startup America project with Steve Case and Scott Case. Steve has also has a role on the Jobs Council, Jobs and Competitiveness Council itself, which I think will be an important place to keep that initiative clearly in mind. And so just when you go back and talk to your folks about how we're feeling here and what the spirit is, and whether we're not going into a shell, we're not trimming our sails. Obviously, we're at a time with very limited fiscal resources, and so we have to make smart, wise decisions with taxpayer dollars. We have to do this. We have to find common ground, and we have to build these. We have to move forward together. We're going to continue to look for bipartisan means to move our policy agenda forward. But outside of here, we want to give everybody the tools and the certainty that they need to be able to continue to move forward, create jobs, make the American worker the most competitive worker in the world, and continue to, and I get little points every time I say this, so I'll say it again, continue to win the future. I do want to thank you for keeping Greg Nelson busy. I tried to give him at least two more jobs. He told me that working as the deputy in the public engagement office and serving as a key advisor to the Jobs Council is enough for right now. But we'll see if we can we'll see if we can get him more. I'm staying. Are we going to take some questions at some point?
I think we'll probably do it after Terry. Yeah.
Okay.
Perfect. Thanks.
All right. I'll do that. But that's the sense I wanted to give you, and that's what the president wanted you all to hear today.
Perfect. Perfect. Thanks, John. We wanted to, when Dean and I were talking about what to, kind of where to go with this session, one of the key topics, obviously, that's of interest to you all are it's innovation broadly and how we create that innovation ecosystem, but also thinking about how we can work with the different parts of the federal government who are doing some pretty dramatic things to help transform what's happening already, and how we can make sure that the innovation system gets the support it needs from us. So we're really thrilled to have with us today the Deputy Director of the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, Terry Reese. She's going to give a little rundown on what's happening at USPTO, and we'll have time for some questions, and then we'll move on to our next speaker. Great. Thanks, Terry.
Thank you so much, Greg. Good afternoon, and many thanks to Greg and Michael, as well as Robert Fee and the White House staff of public engagement for putting this all together. I've got this great speech, this great script, and if this is toward the end of your meetings, I don't want to put anybody to sleep because this is the beginning of the afternoon. So Greg very helpfully pointed out that he wanted to know what is it what we're doing at the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office that's going to help create new businesses, create those jobs, and improve the economy. So I'd like to provide just four high-level points for you. One of them is our new peer-to-patent process. It's just a pilot process. We did it in the high-tech community. That's not life sciences. We did that about 2 years ago, where third parties from outside the patent office could submit publications to the USPTO, because usually it's up to the examiner to identify as much prior art as he or she could find, and also the applicants are under an ethical obligation to present prior art references to the examiner, just to be assured that the examiner has the best prior art in front of him or her when they actually conduct the examination. This peer-to-patent process worked extremely well before. We're on phase two of it right now. It's only a pilot program, but it's working so well that even though it has not been formally implemented here in the U.S., other countries from outside the United States are already copying our pilot program, not even something we've implemented yet. And basically, every applicant who files an application in the patent office, they actually have an opportunity to opt into this system. So if you don't want to opt into the system, you don't want the patent examiner to get tons of prior art thrown before him or her, you have an opportunity to opt in and to say, listen, I want to know, I want to be confident that the best prior art was cited on my patent application. I want to make sure the examiner had the best prior art in front of him or her, and I want to make sure I get a solid set of claims out of the PTO with full scrutiny and review so that if I wanted to enforce that patent someday and it was dissected during litigation, that it would come out as strong as possible. And this peer-to-patent pilot review will probably be expanded and may someday encompass all patent applications, but for right now, as with the rest of the world, we all have IT issues, and we don't want to be inundated with quite that much information until we're ready for it, because we've now moved into the electronic filing age. We're tending not to work with paper. Only in a few isolated situations are we doing that. So this peer-to-patent, I think, is something that's going to reinforce the vitality and the confidence of patent owners. Another thing that we have going right now is my boss, Director Dave Kappos. He was formerly the VP of IP for IBM, a guy who knows computers, very good with the high tech. He knows that the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, we are not exactly cutting edge with our computer system in the Patent Office. And so, you know, we get a briefing just about every day from the our IT person, John Owens, our director, and he tells us what we're doing, what programs we're having problems with. We desperately need patent reform, and that's where Dave Kappos is right now. As you all know, the Senate bill passed 95-5. The House bill, I think, was just dropped this morning. However, many of us had copies earlier, and so we knew what was likely going to be in it. It's a little bit surprising right now because apparently, I just heard in the car when I'm on my way over here, that none of the Democratic leadership has signed on to whatever bill the House has dropped. So I don't understand what the issues are, and I don't understand why the Democrats aren't a little bit more confident with what's going on, other than the fact that it was started in the House, started in the Senate as opposed to the House. So we'll see. But my boss right now is testifying. He wants the patent office, all the fees that we take in, he wants to be able to spend those fees so that we could do a better job, so we can handle the backlog. Right now, our patent backlog is 700,000 patent applications. And that might sound horrible, but most patent offices throughout the world have this very same pendency problem that we have. Dave has done, he's been in the PTO now for 19 months. He's done a fantastic job, you know, trying to take it down. However, guess what? Our economy is getting more vibrant. People are filing more patent applications. So right now we're hiring 1,000 examiners this year. We'd like to hire about 1,000 examiners next year. Right now we have about 7,300 examiners in the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. So that's adding quite a bit more to the PTO. One of the things that we have and that we would like to do is to keep as much of the patent controversy out of the courts as possible. So I think all of you are familiar with the post-grant opposition issues and things that are presented in the bill. Right now we have re-examination, and we have other mechanisms where a patent that needs to be, reconsidered, re-reviewed, new prior art brought to the attention of the PTO can be properly evaluated, just to make sure that it's as good as it can be, it is new and novel, and that if you want to try and enforce it in the court, that you have the best patent application possible. Right now, we envision that if there's some kind of a post-grant procedure, we're not going to need as many of the basic patent examiners who examine the applications. We think that we'll have the backlog attended to by late 2013. We think that we'll probably have a backlog. We think that from time we call it to first action is going to be 20 months or less. So we're going to try and get it less than that. But we've talked to most people in the industry, and there's something called PCT practice, patent cooperation treaty practice, where a patent application is actually not reviewed until 30 months after it's filed. So there's sort of a time frame. People want to see what the industry is going. People don't necessarily want immediate review of their patent applications. However, Dave realizes that we should offer our users a potpourri of choices. And if you're a small startup in particular, and you need venture capital funding, and you want to get a patent application because it's going to be your lifeblood, Dave developed what's called a three-track system. Track one is actually going to be published in the Federal Register, we hope, I think next week, early next week. And track one, for a fee, you pay a bit extra money, and your entire patent will be reviewed and considered within a 12-month time frame. So it's a very compressed, expedited review, and you move to the top of the line. Now, part of the reason we need 1,000 examiners is to make sure that the people regularly filing their patent applications don't fall farther behind and that our backlog doesn't increase. But right now on Capitol Hill, Dave is talking to Congress saying that we need our money, we need to improve our IT system, we need to get more efficient, and we need to hire more examiners. We also have done something that's going to be implemented. It's actually on our PTO website right now. It's called e-petitions, electronic petitions. To those of us geeky patent attorneys in the room, of which I feel like I'm the only one, we have an entire petitions branch in the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. And one-third of those petitions, about 27,000 petitions, are actually just pro forma type petitions where an attorney handling a matter just is petitioning and asking the PTO to remove their name from the case so that they're no longer responsible for it. So a lot of the petitions are just straightforward and what I consider boring, mundane type tasks, where even in a law firm or a corporation, you have a paralegal or an executive assistant do the paperwork. It doesn't require the attention of an attorney. Well, thus far, the Patent Office, we haven't been able to get enough of what we do up electronically. So we have something now called e-petitions, where it's just like magic. Being someone who is in outside practice, I was both corporate and law firm, and I'm a litigator, prosecutor, you name it. I did whatever was fun at the time. To do a petition, I probably could fill it out in 45 seconds. You hit a button, and you immediately get back from the USPTO the fact that it was filed and immediately granted. I mean, it gives everyone business certainty. You don't have to wait for the petition. Are you removed as attorney of record, for instance? Is there lingering liability, whether it's corporate or you're a law firm practitioner, being moderately concerned about things like malpractice? Is somebody going to drop the ball if you're technically of record? So that was just implemented last week. We're going to pull it out with fanfare, I think today or tomorrow. There's going to be a press release on that. So to the extent that we're given the resources that our user groups are paying us for, we are going to be able to improve the Patent Office and make it more vibrant, dynamic, and more user-friendly for all of our user group community. But I've got this great speech telling you that innovation, the Patent Office, jobs, improved economy. So if I just summarize that, that's just the short message, okay, instead of saying it throughout my presentation. And thank you so much. So I guess I do agree to answer questions if anybody has any.
Yeah, great. We're happy to take some questions. We've got a couple minutes now before the next speaker, for Michael Terry and myself. And Dean, good to see you. I wanted to wait till Dean got here before we said this, but big thanks to Dean and to all the team at ITIC for all the help you guys have provided and for obviously bringing everybody in here today. But on everything from our innovation policy to looking at some of the patent reform issues, you guys have been great partners. We really appreciate it. Questions?
Sure.
No, Dave's been a great technical advisor. He talked to the Senate, he talked to the House, he talks to the White House. So no, this bill is something that we think is good. We think that both the Senate bill and we think that the House bill actually has further, it looks like decent improvements on the Senate bill. So depending on what eventually comes out of the House and what eventually might be a compromise, we feel good and confident about whatever comes out. We'll be able to handle post-grant review in no matter what form it comes out. We're already stressing on that. And so we're already moving things around and trying to decide how that's going to be handled. We think that the prior user rights, which was not in the Senate bill, which is in the House bill, is something that we think is a good idea. I can tell you that from the international perspective, people from, I've been also active in this patent reform debate for a while. I was president 2 years ago of the American Intellectual Property Law Association, 17,000 patent attorneys, which are a nice group of people to socialize with, okay? Honest to goodness, okay? So I've followed this for a long time. So I've had clients and I've spoken on the various bills over time, and people say, do you think it's going to happen? And so many times I said yes, that even now, in my heart, I say yes. Verbally, I say, I don't know, because it's just, I followed it for so very, very long. I think that when they dropped the damages portion of the bill and the venues provisions, and the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit seems to be handling those issues well, I think that's good to the extent that our courts can handle the issues in a consistent manner, and we don't need legislation, that's good. Because different patents should have different damages, different value, different perspectives, different ways of looking at it. And how do you put that in a statute? I mean, that's got to be more up to a court to look at issues such as that. But we like both bills. So we think no matter how it turns out, we think it's going to improve the U.S. patent system. And from a global perspective, from people outside the United States, where we're thinking long term, because business and jobs, we're not just U.S. focused. This is an international playground right now. The people from outside the U.S., they think we are like rock stars, that we actually had something to do with the legislation getting this far, because they thought that we were going to negotiate internationally. We'll change our laws if you change theirs. Our position is now we want best practices. We want, here in the U.S., we want to implement the best patent system that we can, and we want as many countries from outside the United States to harmonize their patent laws to make them consistent with ours. And if ours needs a little bit of tweaking for whatever international model we come up with, we can talk about it then. But I just think that whatever comes out, and I do hope something comes out, and I hope it comes out soon, we're not worried. We think it's going to be vetted appropriately. We're going to be It's going to improve our system. Just going to first to file is going to help. It's going to save corporations a huge amount of money and add a lot of business certainty. But
thank you. Other questions? Patent process. Right here.
What would you suggest we
could
do to help you with the Jobs Commission?
Sure. Do you want to go first?
Sure, I'll start. One of the things that the president said during the first meeting, which was actually held in this room of this new iteration of the Jobs and Competitiveness Council, was that it can't only consist of the CEOs in that room, that they have to get out, and they have to go to their networks, they have to go to their peers, they have to go to their communities, and continue to get ideas about how to make America more competitive and how to create jobs. And so there'll be several ways to do this. One, you can always talk to us. And what I think we're looking for right now is low-hanging fruit. What are ways in the short term, immediately, things that we can do to help create jobs in your industry, in your sector, and in your business? Secondly, we're going to be doing meetings around the country, all over the country. Some may include the president. Many will not. But we'll have leaders on that council hosting these meetings as well. And then finally, something called the White House Business Council, which is an interagency coordinating mechanism for our business outreach, are going to do roundtable discussions again across the country. And if you want us to come to your business, if you want us to come to your headquarters, if you want to come to your city where your headquarters is located, and bring a group of people around to sit down and have that conversation, I think that would be fruitful. I think more than anything, we want to provide that open door so that, if you want to write an op-ed to get your ideas to the administration, you can. If you want to go on the cable news and do it that way, you can. But we want to provide a place where there are going to be people who understand your business, understand your sector, understand your needs, so that you can kind of get to, brass tacks on exactly what the issues are. And I think what will happen is, some of them may take maybe long-term things that are going to, we need to start the conversation. People have been working on patent reform for a few years. There may be issues like that. Some of them may be short-term, But I think if we continue to hear the same things across the country from different sectors, from different business leaders, it will help create the kind of momentum to act not only in the federal government, but also with our state and local partners. I have one idea, and maybe, Greg, you can pick up on some others. So I think one of the things that we've heard is that there are a lot of companies that are having trouble finding employees to do the jobs that are in front of them, that they're ready to hire, and that these are jobs that are, you know, of I would call moderate skill jobs. One example could be engineers. You know, where companies have available positions that will take engineers, and we're not talking about, you know, PhDs, but we're talking about, you know, engineers who possibly could gain those skills in a four-year college or in a community college setting, where you could work with the community colleges or local universities to sort of spec curriculum geared towards jobs that exist today. And so I think identifying those needs, I think having a conversation with us, you know, the council launched an initiative called Skills for America's Future. Penny Pritzker and others are leading that effort and initiative. And I think having the, you know, here's what we're looking for. Here are the jobs that are available. Here's what we need. Here's where we are and where those jobs are. Here are the local institutions that can help us train people for that work. And then we can not only bring a larger set of businesses into that conversation, but we can also bring the educational institutions around the table. And then finally work with local organizations, local communities, local elected officials to get the word out, so that we don't have people training, going into job training programs for jobs that don't exist, where there are jobs that exist right now that need a certain skill set. And I think that's the kind of low-hanging fruit where a real large group of companies could get together. I think it'll have an impact of both filling the jobs that you need, helping your businesses grow, and also just changing the spirit and helping kind of propel the spirit around that, you know, there are opportunities here, that this is the great, you know, this is the best place in the world if you want to work, if you want to grow, if you want to live that American dream. And I think that's the kind of low-hanging fruit that the Jobs Council, I know, is looking at, as well as other colleagues within the administration. Yeah. Greg, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, the couple of things I would add, and this will help transition a little bit too, Dean. It's a great question. Are to Michael's point, we've looked at a couple of different strategies for how to make progress on some of these real key issues, and a lot of this has been informed by working directly with you all. There's the legislative direction and the administrative direction where we can make real progress now on big issues like immigration and patent and trademarks by making changes within the administration, doing what we can do to make these processes more streamlined, change the cycle time on them, encourage the to be more user friendly for you all as customers. And that's happening, and we really need you to stay engaged in those processes. So if your patent folks have questions about, think there's ways we can save time, let us know. We want to make sure that same thing on immigration system, same thing in all these areas where you and your team spend a tremendous amount of time working back and forth with us and you know, compliance and permits and all these other areas. So those are slower moving, but we can make a lot of progress. And we've got a tremendous team in all these areas that wants to make progress. Legislative, I think there's some, you know, we know that there are some constraints on what we can get done in the next couple of years. We think there's real opportunities. And Phil Weiser, who's going to join us in a second, is going to talk about a couple of those in particular, one of which is looking at spectrum and wireless, a tremendous opportunity for growth and innovation. The second way we've gone about this is just working directly with you all in public-private partnerships. How do we make sure that on issues that we both care about, we can make progress without necessarily having to have a you know, big comprehensive bill or waiting for a rulemaking process to happen? We know what needs to get done, and we know how to do it in a lot of these cases. So I know we've talked to you all in the past about opportunities to get involved through Skills for America's Future, through Change the Equation, which is focused on the earlier times of STEM education, looking at early childhood, middle school, high school, and over 100 companies involved, and many of you and other ITM members are. And then also Startup America, all the great companies around this table in particular, all started as startups, and most of you have started in the latter half of the century and are all exciting success stories in what makes this country a great place to do business. We want to create another 100 companies like that that continue to grow and be great global influences. And Startup America is a way to try to build support for high growth entrepreneurs. And the two ways that large companies can have a tremendous impact on that are one, through direct involvement, mentorship, helping entrepreneurs get their businesses going. The profile of a successful entrepreneur actually looks a lot more like a 45-year-old who leaves a company and starts a new business in their same industry than it does the 20-year-old dropping out of college to start a new company. That when you look at the where that what the profile of success is, that's who succeeds, and it's often by working with the company that they just left to build out an additional service or an additional product that can be supportive. And then second is looking at how you as a company can think of these startups as a pipeline, as the place where innovation's happening in your field, where there's a huge opportunity to help be the first or second or third customer for some of these smaller companies that can provide real value to you all right now in your supply chain, with even without some of the R&D investments you might not be able to make anymore. So we've got a range of opportunities like that and some example partnerships that are already underway with Startup America that we'd love to talk to you about. Steve Case, as you all know, is the chair of the board of the Startup America Partnership, which is the private sector entity that's a piece of this. They've just hired a new CEO, and they're off and running, and we think there's tremendous opportunity. So we want your help on the legislative side. I think we can all agree that those are often multi-year, sometimes multi-decade battles, but we think that that we have a unique moment in time now to make a real difference in some of these other areas, and want you to be as involved as possible.
I'll make this my last word and then leave, because I know it may spark robust conversation that I'm not I don't think we have the time to get into today. But obviously, corporate tax reform. If your companies, if your CFOs are not engaged with our friends over at the Department of Treasury on this, you know they should be. It's something that I know the Secretary is keen to work through, and obviously we all talk about lowering that rate and broadening the base, and I know that means different things for each one of you sitting in your individual chairs. And so you know, I Dean's been great about putting people into at around the table and into the game on that, but it's something that I think both is categorizes as something that we need to work through in the short term, and I've heard may have an impact on job creation. So thanks a lot, everybody.
Thanks, everybody. All right. We're going to move on to the next segment of our agenda. There's no breaks in here. We're powering right through. We're very pleased to have with us Phil Weiser. I know many of you have worked with Phil in the past. He's the Senior Advisor for Technology and Innovation at the National Economic Council and has been a key driver in developing the administration's innovation policy and innovation agenda, as well as looking at some of the particular opportunities we have over the upcoming months particularly on wireless and spectrum. So I'm going to turn it over to Phil, and we'll have a chance for questions after his chance to talk.
So I know many of you, but not all of you, so if you wouldn't mind a quick sort of round robin, who you are and where you're from?
Steven Savage, CA Technologies.
AD. Oh, yes. Great. So, yeah, we have Osis back here.
Great, thanks.
Thank you. So let me start off with a few words and invite most of all your questions and thoughts. First, innovation and our innovation strategy. We are at a unique point in our nation's history in that the federal government share of the budget that is focused on infrastructure, on innovation, and on education, if you compare it to 1960, is remarkably lower. Yet we're also having a debate about our overall fiscal situation. And a core challenge that we as a country face is how can we confront both these two deficits, the fiscal deficit and the investment and innovation deficit. And this requires a level of vigilance and thoughtfulness about ongoing technological development that this administration has taken on full bore, appointing the first nation's chief technology officer, having an innovation and technology team throughout the government, has been the start of an overall innovation strategy that's spelled out further in a report that some of you may have seen. If you haven't, shame on you, Dean, for not getting it out to everybody. And this innovation strategy mentions, as Greg talked about, the importance of patent reform as an enabler of innovation. I know a number of you have been engaged in that topic. If you haven't and want to talk further, let me know. We are obviously at a critical period today in the House. It's being talked about, passed in the Senate 95-5. We have to focus on our infrastructure. Many people here have been a key partner in broadband, and another area that a little more of a sleeper area, smart grid, upgrading our electric grid, and also our education system for long-term competitiveness. Educational technology is a huge opportunity that we've only begun to glimpse as a country, how to use technology more effectively in educating, particularly in math and science, where STEM education is really about the seed corn of the future. Also, the need for R&D, I'll talk about that specifically in the wireless context, but generally, our nation cannot afford to eat its seed corn. We have to be planting for tomorrow's crops, because if we continue to disinvest in R&D, in a short-sighted decision that we can't afford to, I think we're missing the logic that we can't afford not to, because other countries are, and we can't no longer just presume that our nation will have the skilled workforce and the research and development base to lead the world. That's not something that we can take for granted. A second key point is the internet and internet policy. A number of you have been very engaged on this topic. What you all need to know is we don't think about the internet policy as a series of one-offs: online, copyright, cybersecurity, privacy, network neutrality. It's one internet. It's a different kind of medium. It's an international medium. It's a dynamic medium. And we take the public values of copyright, security, privacy, and competition deeply. We're committed to them, and we're committed to doing so in a way that recognizes the unique nature of this medium. And so a conversation that we are continuing to have, and we'll get together some of you in a couple weeks, if you have interest in this topic, let me and Greg know so we can include you. This is going to be in advance of a meeting at the OECD that I know some of you have heard about, which is an international conversation about internet policy. Because if we as this country get it right and are able to both protect core values in a way that is faithful to the internet as a dynamic medium, good for us. But if we fail to also work with the rest of the world, and they are imposing policies that undermine internet innovation, that's bad for us and our companies who have to compete internationally. So we recognize the stakes here and are focused on the set of individual issues I mentioned, but also the need for a overall coherent set of themes. Third, spectrum and wireless. In the State of the Union, one of the president's signature calls for infrastructure and next generation investment is the need for the fourth generation wireless opportunity to be a game changer. The first generation of the internet was a narrowband internet, which created huge wealth, opportunities, and benefits. Second generation was the broadband internet. And many people suggest the third generation wireless internet, which will include Internet of Things, more and more devices, sensor networks, machine communication, is going to have huge benefits we can only imagine. But those benefits require spectrum. We as a nation are a little bit like New York City as a subway system. We were first in wireless communications, which was great to be first. But when Tokyo built their subway system, they learned a lot from New York, and as a result, have a better subway system. Now, New York's done a lot of great stuff to upgrade their subway system based on the legacy. We have to do a lot of great stuff to upgrade our spectrum management system, because no country in the world starting today would decide they need 300 megahertz of spectrum for over-the-air broadcasting in the beachfront property of spectrum. A lot of that spectrum, by any account, is not used efficiently. What I mean by that is there's lots of over-the-air stations broadcasting in standard definition, which you can do about 2 megahertz, holding a 6 megahertz license. There are other stations that might be using 4 megahertz for multiple channels. But who could channel share and free up spectrum? That sort of win-win, or as economists put it, gains to trade, is the sort of development we want to enable through voluntary spectrum auctions. We also want to hold ourselves accountable for using the government spectrum more efficiently and finding win-win solutions that we believe are attainable. In an illustration of what, you know, the possible is, we did a fast track and identified 115 megahertz of spectrum that we see as able to free up through using sharing and other techniques that we believe will have far greater promise when the long-term effort of government spectrum management continues. So two sides, the government spectrum management and the private sector management, need to come together to free up 500 megahertz of spectrum over 10 years. This initiative was in our budget, and we scored it at $28 billion. First, we said $10 billion of that will be for deficit reduction, because we have to continue to make progress on that front. We also have to think about our nationwide needs and investments. So another large chunk, depending how you count it, but at least 10.5, is dedicated to public safety and the opportunity to develop a nationwide wireless network that's interoperable and gives our nation's first responders the type of technology that today's enterprises like Federal Express take for granted, or for that matter, as New York City Police Chief Raymond Kelly put it, a 17-year-old with an iPhone takes for granted. Police officers can't take a photo with their device, have it immediately sent back, and say whether the license plate they just took a picture of is from a stolen car or not. But that's attainable if you can develop the infrastructure for applications for public safety. We also, as I mentioned, want 98% of the country to have access to this technology. That's going to require an investment in and a reform of universal service. And finally, we want to provide a $3 billion innovation fund so that our nation can continue to have technological leadership in this area. So, to recap, we have a very robust commitment to innovation strategy. You can read all about it and come back and let us know what we missed. This is not a one-time thing. The nature of innovation is it's a changing area. The Department of Commerce is going to be conducting over the next year an exercise to kick the tires on these areas to answer and address hard questions as part of a commitment under the American Competes Act. We have an internet policy that we are taking, again, very seriously with a conversation that will not only be domestic, number of policy areas, privacy, cybersecurity, et cetera, but also will be international. And third, we have a wireless agenda that we see as a core commitment of the president's agenda to competitiveness and innovation, and that we're somewhat optimistic, even in a difficult political environment, is going to continue to gain momentum. So let's get your thoughts and questions.
Thanks, Phil. Questions? Dean? Go for it.
Talking before about tax reform that it's been
You can't ask me to pick between my children. You can ask. But here's what I'll say. You guys have a lot of, you know, people around the table. Here, what I'd ask instead is, can you prioritize among yourselves who's working with me on what issues? Because I have to believe that if Pamela says the internet policy issue for us is a, you know, critical one, that's where I'm putting my effort, that's great. We need your help. And if, you know, folks from Nokia and Qualcomm say this wireless issue is the core, that's great. And if someone from Apple says it's innovation, that's great. So I can't do it for you. I need you to do it based on your own company's DNA and priorities. And if each of you is not engaged deeply on one of these issues, then we're worse off for that, because you guys are this broad innovation and technology community that has made this country great and has led our efforts. And if we're going to continue to have this leadership, I do believe public policy will matter, and we'll need you at the table and engaged. So that's the best I can do.
Do here and then go to Kathy.
Is there anyone here from Google today? They're busy today. Google announced today Kansas City as their 1 gigabit network. So I do think we as a country need to have experiments, because the nature of technology is we don't know. There should be and are a number of 1 gigabit experiments. Google's got one of them. Chattanooga, Tennessee's got another. As for how we mine the experience of that, that's something I think we're still beginning to get our arms around. Other countries are doing it as well. To the extent this becomes a real proving ground, I think universities and others are going to continue to take the lead on it. So yes, it's something we're watching, but I think it's an issue that, as you say, is kind of rising in salience and significance.
Kathy.
So where do I start? Here's the first challenge. Outside of this room, the concept of wireless spectrum is a snoozer. It's ethereal. People can't touch it, can't feel it. So that's our first problem, and it's a pretty big problem. Now, going for us is a score we have of, you know, $25 or so billion. That is a rare kind of revenue raiser. And so Larry Summers, of everything I worked on, this is the one he loved like 10 times over. The reason is because for an economist to hear that you can raise revenue at the same time as you're catalyzing investment innovation is almost unheard of. When you look throughout the budget for what people here call pay-fors, they're talking about ways to put some fee assessment or tax or cut spending. And generally, those sorts of actions have a braking effect on economic activity. Here, freeing up spectrum for wireless broadband has a catalytic effect on economic activity. So that's something that we can get people excited about, and you all, I hope, will continue to play a leading role underscoring and breaking through the noise that whatever discussions you're having about the budget, don't forget about spectrum. Now, I know this is not your issue per se, but I do think in terms of breaking through the noise, it matters. The power around 9/11 and the commitment that we all, as people in the technology space, should make to our first responders is one that we as administration take seriously. It's one that people in Congress take seriously. And it is, you know, arresting to think that we now have in our teenagers, you know, technology in their hands that they're using in all sorts of innovative and effective ways. And we haven't been able to translate that to the sector of people who are about saving lives. So firefighters sometimes are able to get schematics of a building they're going to, but it's in a laptop with a commercial air card kind of, you know, jerry-rigged solution. It's not because we've developed a nationwide marketplace for applications for public safety that enable them to be delivered in the way that they would most want. It's because they put something together kind of on the fly. But we have an opportunity in crafting a nationwide commitment and strategy to do this right for public safety. And I know that different organizations have said, hey, we just care about getting spectrum out of the activity. But I will tell you, we as administration didn't make the public safety commitment, you know, just because we're thinking, hey, this would be nice to do. No, it's because we thought long and hard and said this is the right thing to do for the country. We also think it's the thing that Congress will want to do and will help pull everything through. I would also say, and this is two other points, when you think about the innovation fund, one of the things to think about is this has a level of vulnerability as a political matter, because the painful reality, and I should mention this point as well, this is also true for our commitment to unlicensed spectrum as part of this initiative. Unlicensed spectrum and R&D are seed corn in the sense that, like, it's tomorrow's innovators who are born on unlicensed spectrum or as a result of R&D. And so who's the constituency for tomorrow's innovators? Often it's nobody. If you, well, you guys got to show up. I mean, that's the thing. You've got to show up and you've got to be heard, because, you know, the problem with the companies that haven't been born yet is people can't, again, put a face to it. If it's a today's industry under threat, Congress hears about it. But the possibility of tomorrow's industry often is silent. So, you know, those are some of the pitfalls, I'd say. And, you know, this is an environment where I think we can get a message through, but it's going to take a number of people pushing hard, making the point. So when you go up and talk to different people and are talking about the challenges facing our country and the opportunities, this spectrum initiative is a rare opportunity, because you can raise a lot of money, and different people may have different ideas of how to put it to work. And that's a fine discussion, but let's start from, we're going to get this done, and we have some priorities: public safety, innovation, not leaving rural America behind, and let's have a conversation how to get it best done. This is something that, again, I don't think we can afford not to do. Yes.
But, you know, maybe we need to package that or something, because it's not like they don't talk about it and they're not known. So if there's a void there, somehow we got to figure out how to fill that.
Well, the broadcasters are starting to push back. I mean, you say Congress may want to do this, but in terms of a strategy, repurposing spectrum on a voluntary basis sounds nice, but they don't necessarily agree with you.
No.
I mean, we represent Intel. We want to see it happen. It's vital to a lot of these companies here, but broadcasters are saying, well, okay, voluntary is fine, but then are you going to repack the spectrum on a voluntary basis?
No. This is a really important point that Peter said. I forgot to mention it. Thank you.
And so the encouragement, I'm not sure it's an AR for us, is if you're going to start, I mean, up on the Hill, Greg Waldman and others are coming back at you.
I know.
And so it's getting ugly.
Yes.
And the president, you know, speaks to this. It is speech, a State of the Union speech. It's an incredible comment, but now...
Well, he actually gave, this is just the way life works. He actually came to Marquette, Michigan to speak specifically about this initiative. And does anyone else know what happened that day? Egypt, Mubarak. So it got, you know, totally overshadowed.
He's got the right idea, but then it comes to you to get the NAB in here and the broadcasters, who are incredibly powerful because they're regulated and they clearly are creating, you know, they're pushing back. And so I don't know what...
We've had a lot of engagement with the broadcasters. I will say, apropos your point and getting to the, like, what the you know, hard questions are, repacking is, you have two prongs. One is voluntarily, would somebody be willing to, like, sell their TV station? So if I'm the 27th TV station in LA and I make $800,000 a year, but I'm sitting on spectrum that's worth $100 million, I'm like, wait a minute, I can even channel share, stay over the air, keep my must carry right, and cash out for some portion of the proceeds. That could be a pretty good idea. However, if I'm at channel, like, let's say 38, and we clear some of the spectrum, but we don't have like 46 cleared, we need to ultimately clear a lot of, like, that, you know, let's say up, I mean, 31 up to 51, it's not gonna be that valuable, because you need nationwide blocks, and even regional blocks, they have to be, you know, hopefully bigger sized. To do that, you have to repack the bands. Now, repacking is totally consistent with today's law, because broadcasters have a right to be over the air. They don't have a right to their particular channel. And this is particularly important because the digital set-top boxes can be easily tricked. So the box could still say channel 48, even if you're broadcasting at what used to be channel 24. So what we want to do with the broadcast, say, listen, guys, we will, you know, have a repacking process. We'll pay for all the costs you have. We'll protect you from the lower VHF, which doesn't have as good propagation characteristics. And this will be a great step forward for our country. Now, they may say, we're still nervous. And at some point, we say, we'll do everything we can that's reasonable. But the logic of this for our country is really powerful. And if they say, well, we want to only be able to voluntarily repack, the problem with that is, what do you do if you own the land that's the last plot of land that they want to buy for the airport? You hold out for the highest price possible. So that's what would happen in voluntary repacking. And a reasonable price, absolutely, the cost of moving, but the ability to, like, try to extract a whole bunch of rents, we don't think that makes sense.
Great, thanks. Your question's worse than Dean's.
Well, I'm your friend.
Yeah, I know. So the
I'll tell you.
Well, that's something we have to work on, consider, and come back to you with. I'm not probably fully qualified to be the one to answer. Part just for people who haven't thought about this issue that makes it so challenging is, how do you trade off R&D across biotechnology, information technology, wireless, nanotechnology? And I can't begin to kind of tell you how one would go about doing that. Obviously, that may well be coming down the road, and others, including Jason Furman, who's going to follow me, will have more insight into how that's actually likely to happen. But from sort of a, what would we do in the ideal world if we had to, I can't even answer that question, let alone the real world that Jason will live with.
Great. So I think we have time for one final question, then we're going to wrap up and transition.
Close an action item, especially with Jason in the room as well. We look back in 2004, 2005, when we had the same problem on Spectrum, that there was a battle between broadcasters and everyone else. And in the end, we got an agreement because it was on a must-pass vehicle because it produced $15, $20 billion in revenues. We heard today from CBO that the scoring is about $24.5 billion on the proposal.
Yeah.
That's real money.
Yes.
And what we would, and you have the 911 backdrop as well.
Yeah.
What we would like to do is work with you on a game plan that would require your legislative strategist as well, that tries to get this moving on a must-pass budget.
Ralph, I appreciate it. I already made notes myself to follow up with Dean on that very point. So
it raises money.
Yes.
And it'll force all of the outstanding issues dealing with broadcasters, license versus unlicensed.
Yes.
You know, what you do with E-Block. But in the end, it's still going to produce $20 billion, which is real
Yes.
Money when you're looking for real modest or more than modest steps on deficit reduction. So I think this is one where we can work with you, get
great.
On a must-pass vehicle. Once it's on a must-pass vehicle and everyone knows it's going, all the parties are going to have to come to the table and work it out.
So there are a couple other things. I do think that's going to be our friend, but I also think it's important for people to know why this is important and to know what the issues are and done enough work to figure out, okay, what can we live with? What do we need? And that process is happening now. So for those who want to engage in this issue, now is the time. I'm going to follow up with you and Dean for sure on this. For the rest of your members, if this is your issue, we need you fully engaged on it. If it's innovation strategy and R&D, that's great too. If it's internet policy, that's also great. But these are three critical areas that we need to work together on, and your all leadership and engagement is so important. So thank you all for being here and all you're doing.
Thanks, Phil. Great. Well, thanks, guys. We're going to move to the next portion of the agenda. And we're extraordinarily pleased to have with us today Jason Furman, who's assistant to the president and the principal deputy at the National Economic Council. Jason's going to talk a bit about some of our overview on the current economic situation, what's going on at NEC, and then we'll have time to take some Q&A as well. So, Jason?
Great, thanks. Well, the administration and the president have always been focused on winning the future, but I think it would be fair to say that in the first 2 years, it was probably more about winning the very near future than it was the medium and long term. In the process, when we did things like the Recovery Act, we would try to include broadband, smart grid, high-speed rail, a whole set of things that wouldn't just have short-run benefits, but would have medium and long-term benefits for the economy. But foremost on our mind really was what the unemployment rate would be at the end of 2009, what the unemployment rate would be at the end of 2010. And a corollary to that is that the administration's focus was on a few very big items: the Recovery Act, financial reform, the tax agreement, and obviously health reform. Now we're in a different economic phase. The economic outlook is much stronger. The economy has pretty much created more jobs every quarter than it did the previous quarter for a year now, and that's a pattern that's actually unusual in a recovery. Normally they're sort of bumpy and you have your ups and downs. This one keeps getting stronger and stronger. I was talking to one CEO yesterday who closely monitors 20 industries and said 19 out of the 20 were getting better and getting better faster than he expected, housing continuing to be a challenge and a weak point for us. But what that means is that as the economy gets stronger, we're in a position to focus more on the medium and long-term strength of the economy. And a lot of that centers around the president's innovation agenda, out innovating, out building, out educating the rest of the world. What it translated into in legislative terms is, rather than a few really huge things, is a lot of small and medium-sized things. So spectrum initiative, patent reform, and a whole range of other things, but those would be some of the examples for folks in this room. And, they say small and medium because they're small and medium compared to some of the big mega legislation of the previous years. They're still enormously large in terms of the impact they can have on total factor productivity, on economic growth in the future. Something like spectrum reform, one of the goals is doubling the amount of wireless spectrum available for broadband. So that's the phase we're in now, is those types of initiatives at the same time that we're working on the budget. And part of what we're trying to do on the budget is make sure we can protect some of the gains we've made in terms of investments in the research and innovation areas, and where possible, especially in areas like energy research, expand and build on those gains. So I think it's an exciting time to be here. I think there's a lot of work we can all do together. I think one of those areas also that falls under that heading, probably closer to the medium to large than small to medium, is tax reform. And ultimately, the president thinks the entire tax system needs to be reformed, individual and business taxation. The opportunity we have to move more quickly would be on business tax reform, and that's something the president wants to see if there's a way to do, you know, even more quickly than the whole system. And the reason is because at least some of the most contentious debates about how you tax high-income households and deal with the expiration of the Bush tax cuts and all of that don't manifest themselves in the corporate tax arena. So if you're able to agree on a few simple principles, you want a lower rate, you want a broader base, you want that tax reform to be revenue neutral. If you can get broad agreement on those principles, there's a set of very tough decisions and tough steps you need to take to work out from there. But they're a lot easier than having to work out some of the deeper existential issues around how much revenue the system as a whole is going to raise, how you're going to deal with the expiring tax cuts and all of that. So that's another issue that we're spending a lot of time and focus on right now. So happy to talk about any of the things I mentioned, anything else. I'll just answer that last question before I came in on Spectrum. I think what you want to see is something like the Commerce Committee developing legislation, developing the ideas, whether it ends up being a standalone bill that you need 3 weeks of the Senate's time to pass, or it gets swept up into a bigger thing, and that bigger thing is a budget bill. It's very hard to tell in advance, but certainly at this stage of the process, you want to be working those issues out in a place like the Commerce Committee. I don't think it'd be ready. You know, if they want it in the budget negotiations tomorrow, I don't think it'd be ready for that. But you want it to be ready for, you know, whatever vehicles there are. But anyway, happy to talk about pretty much any economic issue.
Great.
I'll start with where Mike is distraught. Where you also ended, Jason, which is tax reform. And in most of the discussions that we've been having on the Hill, what we've been hearing is that what's most likely is not, it's hard to do.
What's most likely is? So broader tax reform is a multi-year process. I don't think anyone would predict that you'd be able to do it this year. I mean, maybe you would. Things surprise you. I think the question is whether there's an opportunity to move more quickly on the business side, do that separately, and do that more quickly. In some sense, that's a multi-year process too, but that process was actually begun in a lot of ways by the Treasury Department and the Bush administration in 2007, put down three reform plans, began the set of discussions around that. Charlie Rangel had corporate tax reform plans, Democratic and Republican candidates in the past have. So we are a couple years into that discussion. So I think the question is whether there is an opportunity to move more quickly, and if there is, that would certainly be in the business area. And that's what the majority of the outreach we've done to listen to ideas and learn has been in the business area, and the majority of our own internal work and taking everything we're hearing and trying to synthesize it and turning it into more of what a plan might look like has also been in the business area. And when I say business, it's primarily corporate, but you can't just limit yourself to C-corps. It inevitably spills outside of that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we certainly heard from a lot of businesses. A lot of the inputs you get from businesses is actually very consistent, which makes things easier in terms of what the priorities are. Rates, R&D, credit, and territorial, I would say, are the three biggest priorities that we've heard over and over again. The how to pay for those priorities is a little bit less clear and a little bit less consistent. But in general, we've heard a willingness to be willing to do some sort of trade on depreciation versus rates, that if there was a trade-off that needed to be made between those, making that trade-off more in the direction of lower rates, something we've heard a reasonably broad willingness to do. And maybe some of the other exemptions as well, but for businesses, obviously, that depends on the specific plan. So we've heard that. We're trying to take all of that now and figure out, you know, how you'd synthesize it together with the expertise that the Department of Treasury brings to bear, including expertise on what the overall fiscal implications are for the federal government, which is something that no corporate tax director is going to have the capability to figure out. And trying to put that together and figure out what it would look like as a plan in terms of the timing or format or plan or plans or white papers or this or that, that's something that we're working on. But I don't, certainly if we want to act this year, we don't want to take forever on that.
Great. Other questions, Pamela?
Yeah. I mean, one thing we can do on exports is getting people to actually pay when they use your products. You don't really need more people in China using Windows. You just, if they just paid for them, that would do a lot for our exports. So that's one area that I'm sure you're working with my appropriate colleagues on. The free trade agreements, in terms of our actual economic goals and exports, South Korea is the most important of them. Colombia and Panama are important trading partners and important to the United States. And we're working very hard and very quickly to try to conclude those agreements. But South Korea was obviously completed at the end of last year, and it's the one that is economically most important to us. In terms of other things we're doing, export controls has been an important focus of work, and something that I assume is important to this group. Dealing with piracy, dealing with credit issues around exports and Exim and expanding the resources that they have, being just more aggressive about commercial diplomacy, and the Commerce Department has obviously played a big role in that. These are all the different parts of the National Export Initiative that have been important.
Tim?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's any area that has had more strategic thought go into that, and I think that thought, as you just said, is proportional to the economic importance and opportunities that the United States has in a country like China. We've certainly tried to step up our trade enforcement in areas where it's been appropriate with China. There's an ongoing dialogue about the currency and exchange rates that I'll let my colleagues at the Department of the Treasury characterize and comment on, not me. You know, one issue we've had is we've had, you know, a lot of companies who have been willing to come to us and privately tell us what their problems are with China and Chinese trade practices, but then are less willing to talk about it publicly because you have your own, you need to engage with the government there and satisfy things there. So certainly for all of you to be able to say more in public, lay the public groundwork for when your IP is being infringed on, when non-tariff barriers are keeping things out of markets there, or whatever other practices you see, having that public pressure, I think, helps us as we're trying to negotiate and work with the Chinese as well.
Other questions for Jason? Okay, great. Well, I know that we have a whole bunch of things to follow up on. We'll work with you guys on that. We, as is our tradition here, we'll send a follow-up email via Dean and crew with links to some of the things we talked about today. Certainly, the innovation report. We'll send you links to some of the partnerships we've got going on that we'd love to keep you all engaged on, and make sure that that you're part of our innovation newsletter so that you can get information on everything that's happening here. I think all of you have my contact info, but if you don't, Dean or the rest of the team at ITI can certainly give you that, and we're happy to work with you all directly in any issues that come up. If you have any additional questions for Jason, feel free to shoot my way. We can make sure that happens. Anything else you want to add before we wrap up?
No, but look forward to working with you on all these issues.
Great. Thanks, everybody. Thanks for your time today.